Welcome to season four of The Culture of Kindness. My name is Nahala Summers and I am your host. A culture of kindness is based on the idea that by bringing kindness into leadership, we reduce stress, anxiety, make happier workplaces, and in turn, improve the bottom line for any organization or institution. It is a book, leadership program, accreditation, and of course, this wonderful podcast. Kindness has been my life's work since I founded the social movement for kindness back in 2012 called Sunshine People. And it has kept me interested on what people have to say on the complexities of kindness ever since. The guest lineup is exceptional, from politicians to social media influencers, best-selling authors to BBC presenters, an eclectic mix of people who all have completely different views on kindness, how we get it, and where the world is currently at. If you enjoy this episode, then please do show your support for kindness by subscribing to the podcast, leave a five-star review, or simply invest in the book, aptly named A Culture of Kindness, available on Amazon. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much, John and Hisham, for coming on and being guests on A Culture of Kindness. You're my first two-guest podcast, so we'll see how this goes and try and jam in all of the information in just 30 minutes. So I guess, first of all, because you're both from the NHS, let's talk about that and introduce yourselves and your kind of journey within the NHS. I think that would be great. It'd be great to start with yourself, Hisham, if that's okay.
Hi, Nahala. Thank you for inviting us to speak. So I am I'm a doctor. I'm a consultant paediatrician. I've been working in the NHS now for nearly 20 years. And I've got another role now in my position, which is around improving healthcare services. So I'm quality improvement lead, my trust for my organisation within the NHS.
Wonderful. And John?
Hi, I work for NHS England as their head of quality improvement. I cover the London region, and I've been working in that space of supporting hospitals to improve services through quality improvement teams, transformation teams, and so on for the last few years. I did a little bit of service management, joining through the NHS graduate management scheme. And before that, I had a career in the army as an officer in the Royal Engineers.
So, I mean, you both talking about improvement, both talking about the NHS, you know, and before we kind of move on, because I'm kind of going to veer off a little bit, but and because I'm really interested, the NHS is huge. It's a beast within itself with so many different facets, and I know that there are kind of different areas and regions and people are doing different things. How easy is improvement within the NHS? How do you tackle those challenges of just the vastness of it?
So I guess that really is my most pressing question. That's what keeps me up at night and what gets me up in the morning. So my first kind of experience with the NHS, actually before I joined the NHS, was when my dad, who was an immigrant to this country, he came as a doctor himself, actually as an obstetrician from Egypt. And I remember when I was a kid, he talked a lot about the National Health Service, you know, a real kind of jewel in the crown. And I, in many ways, he was my inspiration to come into healthcare. And I went into medicine, mainly because of that, actually. So he was my hero, although I don't think I ever told him that. And coming out of medical school, there was a real dissonance, actually, between what I wanted to deliver, the care that I'd been trained to deliver, and the care that patients were receiving. These kind of chasms sometimes in the patient pathway. And trying to fill those gaps essentially is what drives me to do what I am doing now. And certainly during those early years as a young doctor, as a trainee paediatrician, I used to try to do a little thing within my own sphere of influence or sphere of control. Very little, I would say, made a huge difference, and certainly nothing was sustainable. And it was only through learning about myself, learning about how to influence, learning the technicalities of quality improvement, that I've perhaps picked up on a few things. And now I see my role is helping staff who deliver the service to improve the service.
Yeah, I'll add to that. I think it's as you say, the NHS is so massive. It can feel overwhelming at times and really difficult to identify how you as a person can have an impact in that space. So I see lots of large scale change programs taking place, which involve massive sums of money, as you'd expect, and the feeling often there is that you get swept up in the program and you follow the general tide of that program and contribute where you can, but they often feel quite top down, and you often feel like you lack any autonomy to really bring yourself to the program and have impact. So there's a lot of that going on. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are individuals trying to passionately, I guess, run on fumes to make little changes where they can in their services. And what I'm starting to see where things can be more effective is where people can get that sort of that sweet spot somewhere in between there, and really some of the magic ingredients are a purpose, really, really understanding purpose and where that value can make a difference. Knowing how as an individual you can contribute your skill sets to maximum effect and have some sort of autonomy and local leadership to do so, and for things to be manageable. So I see lots of change at opposite ends of the spectrum, but not in that sweet spot in the centre. And what me and Hisham have been focusing on a lot recently is helping people get that sense of community around their purpose and that power that community can bring to find allies who are practical and can support you in what you're doing. I'd finally just add as well, I'm increasingly becoming aware of the impact that innovation has in that field as well, through an understanding of value fixing a real problem and then supporting almost the commercialization of an innovation to get scale and spread, where we often get the scale and spread quite badly wrong in improvement programs.
Mm. Have you got examples of that, John, like where you've seen that happening? Maybe not even within the NHS, because maybe you don't want to say
There certainly are. I mean, on the innovation side, we've been fortunate enough to be part of something called the NHS Clinical Entrepreneurs Programme, run by a chap called Professor Tony Young. And that brings together basically clinical innovators that identify value and deliver it in the NHS system. And there are some really, really high impact examples there of people delivering that value. And they know they're delivering that value because people are prepared to buy it. And they buy it because they make services safer and more effective and more efficient. And I see much more effective scale and spread through that program. Now, they've got an alumni of probably 500-600 people at the moment. So I could give you 500-600 examples off there. And they range from, you know, interventions in surgery through to software for managing pathways through operating theatres, through to education tools. There's even one guy who's working on creating a more cleaner, environmentally friendly NHS. The full spectrum. But But yeah, plenty of examples there.
So you talked briefly, I'm going to go back to Hisham in a minute to talk about gaps in the service and how we think that we can do that, because it's very much about culture and what can we do that, maybe not just within the NHS, but as a whole. But John, just to, before I go to there, you talked about the autonomy of leadership, you know, where people are being given that. And I guess within the NHS, that's quite challenging as well. You know, you're caught between a rock and a hard place, because people are, you know, people's lives are on the line. And so therefore, kind of this checklist and going through process is very, very important. And then being able to give people still the autonomy of leadership, is it that easy?
Yeah, and there's the huge distraction of the bigger machine at play here. So,
yeah.
I was talking to an innovator the other day, and they were they're sort of their baby, their focus is on feeding busy staff during the night shift, nutrition on the night shift.
Yeah.
And of course, if we wanted to give that person autonomy at a hospital level, and they're saying, like, I really want to improve services, I want to get involved, you just know that the big machine, the central leadership, is going to say, well, if you want to help, right now there's a pandemic, so pull up a chair and we can call people about booster vaccines, or you can help, you know, shepherd queues of people waiting in a vaccine clinic. That's where you're needed right now. And we could fast forward or rewind to any year, and there'll always be some big main effort like that, you know, reducing waiting lists or what have you. And so how do we give those people that are on a pretty precious workforce salary budget, how do we give those precious resources time and space to not address the main effort at the moment? Really, 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 really tricky balance to get that right.
Yeah, I interviewed somebody who's reasonably quite high up in the police force, very similar, you know, time to be able to train rather than do the job, you know, for self-development, self-improvement. And you need that to do your job well and then not be tired, to have the downtime. But there's always something that's an emergency that needs some support. And that makes it very hard, I think, doesn't it?
One thing that really surprised me when we spoke about this a while back was back in my military days. It's really common in the military for your working week, your working year, to have about 50% of it as training time.
Yeah.
50%.
Nowhere else in the world.
But of course, that doesn't happen by accident. That happens by quite deliberate, careful workforce planning to factor that in. And yes, that's probably not a level of training we could get away with in healthcare. But arguably, I think the current state of affairs is also not quite right either.
No, absolutely. Hisham, you were talking there earlier about the gaps in the service. You know, it was one of the things that you noticed first of all, and you've been bridging that. What have you taken away as being, and I guess most of this is transferable to anybody in any business or any part of their life, but how have you worked at trying to bridge those gaps?
Well, the phrase that John used earlier, kind of running on fumes, really kind of resonated with me, actually. Because, I mean, coming back to Hexsign, this platform that we've developed, in many ways that was born out of that frustration. And certainly for me, I remember this probably what should have been really the high point of my career, actually. I was a clinical lead for my paediatric department, which was quite a novel service. We just reconfigured our paediatric or children's services within North Warwickshire. So there was a real sense of purpose amongst my team that we were trying to, we were kind of ahead of our time really, trying to think about population medicine as well as patient medicine. And for many reasons, what the work that I led, that we were doing, became all the more significant when my dad passed away due to substandard medical care, actually. And so the kind of concept of how do we make our services safer and more effective for the patients that we served was really important. And I remember actually that was one of the main reasons that our trust came out of special measures. In fact, I remember the day that happened, because there was a big announcement. The chief exec said, you know, can everyone who can get to the canteen, come to the canteen. And it was a small enough hospital to probably achieve most of that. And I remember as he made that announcement, that our trust had really transformed the way that we were working. There were genuine tears, because people had been working really hard to be able to achieve that. But what I didn't know at the time was actually that was probably the beginning of the end. Because as that happened, the chief exec, as often occurs in these situations, got poached by a different larger organization. Nurse director, I think, went to Dubai, all places. The medical director retired. So that kind of top team kind of disbanded, really, that kind of cohesive group. And what I didn't know at the time was that there was no parachute payment, as you would do, say, in football parlance. You know, someone gets demoted from the Premiership, they get a little bit extra money, whereas for us that wasn't the case. Even though we'd succeeded, that wasn't available. And so the conversations all went from quality to finance and how do we sustain the service. And I found myself between that rock and hard place that he described, you know, coming in early, leaving late, trying to keep the service together. And crucially, and this I guess is the most important part of the story, I didn't really reach out for help from others, including my own team, actually, you know, and I became more and more ostracized, I would say, because I wasn't able to achieve either what they needed to happen, nor did I really fulfill the needs of the organization. And as we started losing staff, the services kind of fragmented, I found myself getting increasingly burnt out through that process, to the point where I resigned, not just my clinical lead role, but my job as a consultant, actually. So this job that I aspired to be since I was a kid myself, I just wasn't able to do. So I was kind of both unemployed as well as probably unemployable for the first time in my career. And it was during that kind of low point in my career that I kind of really reflected on what needed to happen. And I came across this intriguing concept in my local community called time banking, which I'd never heard of before. But I kind of joined this local time bank, and essentially how it works, and for those of your listeners who've not come across it before, it works using this kind of credit system whereby if you're in a local time bank, say out of your next door neighbor, breaks their leg, you can spend an hour of your time helping them out by mowing their lawn, say, and you get a credit for the hour that you spent with them. And then you could use that credit next time you need help, say, I don't know, filling in your tax return. You can get one of the local accountants to help you with that, and you pay them with that one credit. And I saw this, I was totally amazed by this concept, because it achieved, as I could see at the time, three things. Firstly, get stuff done without having to pay for it, which is pretty cool. Secondly, it connected other people within that local community who wouldn't have otherwise connected. And thirdly, and this was probably the subtlest but the most important for me at the time, was because it was focusing on assets rather than deficits, what you can do rather than what you can't. Suddenly it felt really good to be able to see that. So you may be down on your luck, you may be unemployed, but you can mow a lawn. And that puts you in a much stronger position. And I could start seeing the correlations between that kind of local community with what was happening in my professional setting, in healthcare settings, because we were also short of resources. No one had any money. We're also working in our silos. Sometimes people down the same corridor would know one another, let alone, you know, in the same organization. And thirdly, we often focused on what I couldn't do rather than what we could. So this kind of deficit rather than asset-based approach. And I kind of raise the question as to whether this kind of time banking idea, by which everyone's time is valued equally, by which you can give and take help and encourage to seek help could actually achieve both those things, both helping build resilience in individuals as well as the system, as well as improving the care of the patients that we were serving. And it was that point that I this kind of idea was in my head, really, that I met John, and we took it from perhaps just an idea to something more tangible. I don't know, John, if you want to pick up from there.
Yeah, I just add to your sort of second and third points there around connection and having an asset-based approach. What struck me as a manager in coming new into the NHS from the military was I was hearing stories like Hesham's all the time. It's shockingly unsurprising just how many clinical staff are experiencing, I mean, burnout is what Hesham's describing there. And but ironically, what was troubling me was there was a large amount of staff that could be supporting people like Hesham, and they had the skills and the will to do so. They just didn't know when and where people like Hesham were having that trouble. And really, what I was touching on was the need for a market where clinicians at the front line in times of burnout and extreme stress could access resource from those that had capacity and freedom to do so. We just don't have that market. We rely on quite a clunky HR market. So when you have a skill gap or a requirement, you basically have to recruit somebody, and that person might be recruited 6 months down the line if you're lucky at all. And it just became increasingly obvious that with this massive 1.3, 1.4 million workforce of people unified under an NHS badge, that we could be doing far more with what we already had. And I'll be the first person to say, as a non-clinical manager in the support services, probably at the same time Hesham was burning out, I had capacity to help him. I just didn't know where he was and what he needed and how to help. And there would have been plenty of people around. So that point around that Hesham raised around time banking and connection, really, really important. And I saw it through the lens of a market, and what we essentially overlaid was a market with a time bank on Hexi Time. And then the other thing is that asset-based approach, because for me, what that asset-based approach is doing is fostering that autonomy that I was saying is so important in that improvement journey. Because with the asset-based approach, you're allowing the individual to self-identify the skill, the capability that they have that they want to contribute and support other people with. And if you think about it, that's really, really quite radically different to how workforces currently are at the moment. At the moment, you self-identify by your job title. So like if I give you a really extreme example that happened to me last year, my job title really, like for argument's sake, NHS manager. When the pandemic kicked off, I got redeployed to the NHS Nightingale Hospital. Clinical environment, as an NHS manager, they're like, well, not a lot we can do with you, so work in the mortuary. And I did shifts in the mortuary, moving bodies around between fridges and the funeral services. And that was fine. It filled a need. But as it happened, with my previous career as an engineer in the military, I literally led the construction of field hospitals in third world countries. And if I park my ego to one side and just look at it objectively, I could have led the construction of a field hospital like the Nightingale. I had the CV and the skill set to do so. It wasn't in my job title. Because it wasn't in my job title, HR workforce had no idea of that skill set capacity. And there were stories like this all over the place. I was often surprised just how many receptionists in the NHS are PhD students or waiting to get into medical school next year. Same with healthcare assistants. And my point being, your job title is very rarely an accurate reflection on on your capability and the skills and the potential you can bring to problem solving and innovation in the NHS. So that asset-based approach allows you to identify what you want to contribute to that labour market and to do so with that autonomy. For me, that's really, really, really important.
It's interesting because I talk about this within the book on a culture of kindness, is looking at the whole person, you know, understanding what somebody does in their own life, in their personal life, the things that they actually really enjoy, because actually what they are currently doing may not be giving them the greatest joy, but, you know, and that's, it's a slightly dumbed down version of what you're talking about there, but it is the same in the fact that understanding each other as a whole is, I don't think it's just the NHS. I think it's many organisations who don't see the whole person. They just go, oh, and so you're just this. And actually, you know, like you say, people do adventures. They have lots of things they'll do of an evening as things that interest them, but they've never got involved with. And so it goes on. I imagine that that causes, certainly for yourselves as you look at it, a great deal, and for everybody within the NHS, there must be this great deal of frustration because the huge machine that you just can't shift at times.
Yeah, and with that big machine, the machine wants you to be a cog in that machine. It doesn't want you to be a complicated widget that can do multiple things. It wants you to be a cog and fit in your place and do a good job of it. So, you know, what I think one of the things you're touching on there, and we see it increasingly, is people want these sort of portfolio careers. You know, Hisham's a paediatrician, but he's not just a paediatrician, right? He's got this whole improvement, non-clinical role in his job as well, and he's capable of doing so much more than simply, you know, treating children. And so he is metaphorically multiple cogs that could be fitting in multiple parts of the machine at multiple times, and a simple HR workforce system can't comprehend that.
No.
In the same way that you might want a portfolio career, or even just within your job, you might just want to dabble a little. You know, if let's say you work as an accountant, you might not just want to balance books every month. You might want to take a couple of hours here and there to diversify, learn, apply other skill sets in other places. And time banking's really exciting in that regard, because it's looking at that capability in hourly increments. Mm. Hourly increments, not annual salary figures or monthly pay packets that really limit you to doing one job and knuckling down and just getting on with that one job and not having that broader self that you can bring to the party.
Mm. I'd add a third aspect to that, Nahla, as well. So we talked about autonomy and competence. Professor Michael West describes the ABC of motivation within healthcare setting, but applies elsewhere. And those are autonomy, belonging, and competence. And that second one, the belonging, I think is equally, if not more important, in terms of increasing both the motivation of staff, but also their own capacity. Because when you feel that you're part of a tribe, where you feel that you can both give as well as ask for help, that's actually massively liberating, particularly in an industry like ours, healthcare settings, whereby lack of competence is seen as failure, because failure is often associated with harm. Staff understandably struggle to admit that they don't know. Yet what happens within an environment where you feel, and John uses the word community, and this is what we're trying to build, where you feel you're part of the community, it means that you can both give and as well as ask for help. Yeah. And that safe space for, I guess it's the first time we've used that word, for kindness, but for actually the derivative of the word, the etymology associated with kinship, when you're part of a group of individuals where it's safe enough to say you don't know, or to be who you really are, I think is also really important within our professional kin, as it is within other communities that we might belong in. And part of what I think we're trying to develop is that kinship, that sense of community, of purpose to improve healthcare settings. And HexiTime, as we're developing it, and as it's developing, really, is a platform to allow those communities to grow individually as well as collectively.
I'm such a fan of HexiTime, everything that you represent. And I was going to say, you know, there's the link with, of course, connection, and you've summarized that so much better than I was ever going to say it. But there is something that about HexiTime for me that starts us, giving us a tangible way to bring ourselves back to each other, to understand that connection, you know, and that's everything about Sunshine People, it's everything about a culture of kindness, but ultimately that the value really lies in every human connection that we have rather than the finance of everything. And when we focus on that, money will come, the money that we need in life will come from that. And so, yeah, I absolutely adore HexiTime and everything that you represent. I can't wait until it goes far beyond the healthcare sector and grows out. I'm sure it will. Right, we've already come to the end. There are 1,000 more questions for HexiTime and for you guys, but I will ask you one final question, which is always the final question on this podcast, which is, what does a culture of kindness mean to you? And I will let you decide who goes first.
Well, yeah, and I'll try not to steal your thunder, Hisha, but I think for me it was as Hisham described a moment ago. When I identify that culture, it's that safe space. It's feeling comfortable and relaxed enough to say you don't know and to ask for help and to be grateful and respectful and glad of the help when it comes. And there's probably something in there about not necessarily feeling like you owe anybody anything as well, to accept help and take that and be at peace with it. That to me feels like a culture of kindness.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that, John. I think it's really nicely described. I think there's some really strong links there between, as we were both saying there, belonging and becoming. So when you feel the connections that Nahala described, where you feel part of something bigger than you are individually, you can both be and feel enough, but you can also become the person that you are meant to be. And I think that is what a culture of kindness can achieve.
Amazing. Nobody ever says the same thing at the end when I ask, and I'm always like, wow, that's every answer is always a wonderful answer to me and is insightful and leaves me with something to think about. Thank you so much for your time today. People can look you up at HexiTime. You are getting, well, I mean, I'm following everything, so I see you all the time, but people should be following you, should be joining in with what you're doing. Take some top tips from you guys. Thank you so much for your work and for everything that you do within the NHS. I know the audience will be grateful too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have loved this episode, please do share it with others. Pop on and give a lovely review, but mostly take forwards into your life something that can change someone else's. We are looking for the elusive happiness, and kindness is the action that can get us there.